Gilad, how are you?
I'm doing great, Charles. Good to see you again.
It's great to see you again. So, of course, people who don't know you, you're Gilad Braca. Of course, now you are working at Google. Last time we talked, you were at SAP Labs. And I kind of want, right off the bat, wanted to ask you about Dart, which is what you've been working on for a little while.
Yeah, I joined Google in July, so I've been at this for a few months now. And, yeah, I'm excited about it.
Cool.
But, you know, ask me something specific.
I will. So basically, the notion of optional types and things like that, why did you, like, explain that to people out there? What does that
mean?
Okay,
so optional types is an idea that, you know, people have had for a long time, this desire to combine advantages of statically typed languages and dynamically typed languages. And there's been a lot of variations in the research community over decades over trying to get a system where you have you can combine those things in some ways. In particular, we did some work a long, long time ago on a system called StrongTalk that I've probably plugged on Channel 9 before.
Yep.
And one of its many innovative features was that Smalltalk being a very dynamic system, but we had an optional type system. And what that meant was you could, if you wanted to, add type annotations. There was a syntactic extension to Smalltalk which would let you add these annotations, you know, add variable declarations, parameter declarations, that sort of thing. And you didn't have to do this, so you could write regular Smalltalk, or you could write as many types as you wanted. There was a type checker that you could invoke, Smalltalk usually working in an IDE interactively. There'd just be a menu item that you could ask, okay, type check this method for me, or type check this class for me. And that would give you a set of type errors, but these were really warnings in the sense that they, unlike a traditional statically typed language, the fact that the type checker wasn't happy didn't mean you couldn't run your code. It still ran exactly like Smalltalk code always runs.
Sure.
So in that sense, it was optional because the counterpoint to optional is a mandatory type system, which is you have to have it. That's what people are generally used to. And here, basically, you could use it as much or as little as you wanted. If you couldn't figure out a way to satisfy the type system or didn't want to bother, you could say, okay, it complained, but I'm still going to go ahead. On the other hand, I could say, ah, yes, this really caught a problem for me, or I'll make it so that it shuts up. I'll just change the structure a little bit so I'm sure that I'm golden in that respect. So that was the origin of this idea, and this is something we did way back in like the early and mid-90s. And I did this with at the Anamorphic project that did StrongTalk, back with Lars Bach, who's now running the Dart project.
Yeah.
And so Dart has something similar that's sort of a descendant of that idea. And it's gotten even more radical over time. So what Dart has, again, has the ability to optionally add type annotations in the usual places where you'd put types, return types of methods, parameters, assignments, and so forth. But it, in some ways, it goes both beyond on the one hand and less on the other hand, because it goes beyond because we have this mode called checked mode, which is intended for development, where all these type annotations, wherever you have an assignment or a parameter being passed or something being returned from a method, will automatically insert an assertion that tests if the actual dynamic value, the object being passed at that point in time when the program is actually running, conforms to the static type that's written. You know, either if you're assigning to a variable, it's the static type of the variable. If you're passing a parameter, it's the type of the parameter. If you're returning from a method, before the actual return, we'll check against the declared return type of the method. And it's trickier than that because there's generics and you have to substitute and all this beautiful stuff, but that just makes it interesting for the poor souls who have to implement it. But the net effect is we actually validate your type annotations. Since we do it at every value transfer, that's usually too expensive to use in production, but you can use it in development, and it's a good way to kind of check things and catch things a little earlier than you might otherwise. That's an important aspect of this system. The other part is that, on the other hand, the Dart system isn't a traditional type system like the StrongTalk system was, because StrongTalk really was a sound type system in the classic sense, where if you annotated everything, and ran the type checker and it said you were okay, you have the usual guarantees, right? It was sound. It meant that you would not get a type error at runtime.
Okay.
Dart doesn't really go quite that far. We issue warnings on some cases, but not others. We've deliberately chosen, sort of on an ergonomic basis, if you will, what errors to post. Not every possible violation of the type checker is something we want to report to the user. We report ones that we are pretty sure are very likely to be errors, but a lot of things that might be errors but might be not, we shut up about, because we really, the target for this are web developers. People, some of these people may never have seen a type before and may not ever want to see a type, and so we don't want this to be in people's face. We want it to basically be unobtrusive.
Okay.
So there are a lot of situations in programming where you find that the type error isn't a real error, but it could be an error, and the type checker is conservative.
Sure.
So a typical case is you have some data structure, has a lot of heterogeneous data in it. What type can you give it? You say, well, it returns object when you query it. Problem is, you often have semantic knowledge. You know that if you query this data structure, you look a certain kind of key, or you call a certain procedure, it will actually dynamically return a certain kind of data. The type checker doesn't know that. It screams at you when you take this out. It's an object, and you're assigning it to a string or to whatever. Mm-hmm. And what you do is, okay, I'll insert a cast. Right? We don't want the developers in this particular language, they're not from that culture. At least we don't expect all of them to be from that culture.
Okay.
And we don't want them struggling with, battling them with the type checker just to make it shut up.
Sure.
Right? This is likely the correct dynamic behavior. After all, it is primarily a dynamic programming language, and it would work just fine without any types, and you have that option. So we might say, okay, you're assigning object to a string, but that's okay, because they're on the same inheritance chain, and it's probably a matter of a cast. That's quite likely. So, of course, we might be wrong, and there might be an error there, but again, it's a dynamic language. The error will manifest itself dynamically in a relatively safe way, right? This isn't something where, it collapses, right? Most mandatory type languages, the classical things like Java or C Sharp or C++ or whatever, once you violate the type system, you're outside the language's model, right? Because it's optimized itself to hell based on that type system,
okay.
And otherwise, you get memory violations, right? They're talking to a field that isn't there, and it's actually going to hit some part of memory that's different and completely corrupt your program. Dynamic programming languages don't work that way. You get some orderly, in an object-oriented language, you get a message not understood or a no such method error or exception of that sort. Mm-hmm. And you're never outside the programming language's model, right? It has a model of how you call things, and you get reasonable errors. Yes, they're dynamic errors, and you will get them anyway. So we don't have to be so anal about strictly adhering to the type discipline.
Now, let me ask you a question. I mean, clearly, if the first question, we'll step back just 1 second. I mean, what is it about the web where dynamic languages make so much sense? That's the first question. Then we can go into the second part, which will be about the hybrid nature and how you really do want to be static maybe in certain parts of your program architecture, but dynamic in other places. Can you talk a little bit about the first
question?
Sure.
Okay, so, well, I'll give you two answers.
Two answers.
For the price of one. Don't
Thank
worry.
Thank you.
First answer is there's nothing about the web that's special. Dynamic languages make sense for everybody. It's fine in all cases.
Okay.
And they have huge advantages regardless of the web. They were great before the web. They're great for the web.
Okay.
Now, in the web in particular, you do a lot of client-side programming. You're dependent on dynamic inputs. You are loading things and configuring them dynamically. And so those things are harder to do with static typing. It's also a cultural issue. Just as a point of history, JavaScript is the scripting language that's in the browser, and so people who program with the web have gotten used to dynamic languages. And people who get used to dynamic languages do not like to make the transition. Now, it's probably true the other way around. People get habituated to a certain style of working, and they think that's perfect, and they don't want to change. So it would be very difficult for web programmers to be forced into a very traditional static discipline. On the other hand, my view, having worked in both the dynamically typed world and the static world, is that there are advantages to each of these. And I've always been a eat your cake and have it too kind of person. So
really?
Absolutely. And so that's why we did the work way back with Strong Talk, was what we're, you know, knowing small talk and knowing that it works great dynamically, and yet knowing that there's some advantage somewhere of having these types around in some cases. And those advantages aren't necessarily the ones that the users of traditional type languages always ascribe to them, but there are advantages, and we're trying to combine the two. Mm. Now, you had another question, but I've forgotten it because I was talking for so long.
No, that's fine. So I guess the other question would be, in this sort of hybrid context, which is what we have here, of static and dynamic, and the nice balance that can be arranged and achieved by the developer using the code or using the programming language, where do you see it from a practical standpoint of it makes sense to go static here? Like, for example, when I'm designing my application, it could make sense that in certain contexts, I want strong type verification up front. And in other ones, I'm going to be much more flexible. Does that make sense from an architecture standpoint?
It may make sense to somebody, but not particular to me. That's not how I'd categorize it. I guess let me rephrase your question.
Yeah, please do.
How should I be using these kind of types, right? In a traditional language, either there are no types and I don't worry about them, or it's statically typed and I have to use them everywhere, and the question doesn't arise. I don't have to think about this issue. What happens here is now I have to decide, you know, what style am I going to use? There are people who are coming to this language who are coming from the statically typed world, and their inclination is to stick types right and left. They're just going to make it look like what they were used to. In fact, if you take a Dart program and you go to that extreme, you find it sort of looks like a C-sharp or Java program. If you put no types in, it looks vaguely like a JavaScript program or a Python program. Not exactly, but it has that feel. And the question is, those are two extremes.
Yeah.
And we're not recommending you go to either of those, right? The question is, where should you use the types? And I'd say you should use them, for example, in your APIs is the most important place. So maybe you don't even bother with the bodies of your methods, but the most important thing about types is that they document programmer intent. And so put them in your public APIs, put them in your method signatures. And even if you don't bother type checking your code internally, there's value there because your users can see the API, and it's a lot easier to figure out what it's about and what it's doing and what you need to feed it if those types are there. Sure. So that's like the first thing I'd do.
Okay.
Now, going beyond that, there's still this idea of using types as documentation. You can stick them in on places where they seem to make a lot of sense. Right? There are places where the types are sort of obvious. So maybe you don't want to repeat it. Right? When you have variable A is being assigned new foo, you can look at that and you pretty much can understand that A is a foo, and maybe it's not too important to you to clutter your code with more types, especially if the types are long or whatever. But there's a balance there, because one of the nice things the types do for you, that's documentation for the humans, but what about the poor machines? We sort of have enslaved them and we abuse them, but don't they deserve documentation too? So what I really mean by this is there's a lot of nice tooling you get in the IDE that can leverage the type information.
Yes.
And so all these things that you get where with name completion, right? If we know the type of the expression that came before, now we know, we can tell you what your choices are, what method invocation you can give, and things like that. So that might motivate you to stick more types on your variables so that we can track the types more accurately.
Okay.
So that's a fine thing to do as well. Now, again, you can type check your code. In fact, depending how the tools are configured, it may be happening all the time in the background as you type, and when you submit your methods, well, there'll be something hopefully not too in your face, right? Because these aren't errors, they're warnings. You can't get a static type error in Dart. You can only get a static type warning.
Okay.
Because it'll never prevent your program from running or compiling, right? You should be able to write complete garbage in your type annotations. Not that I'm encouraging that, but in principle, it shouldn't matter. You can be inconsistent. Very often, the beauty of dynamic programming languages is they let you be inconsistent while you're developing. You don't have to have figured everything up front. They don't impose an order on you. You cannot compile this method because you have not completed all the definitions it is referring to, and so forth. It's a lot easier to incrementally build up your code in these things. And we want that same feel, that scripty feel of not imposing a workflow on people.
Interesting.
And so you can put types, and they could be nonsense, and you can still proceed. And it's very key to this notion of optional typing is that the types don't change what your program does at all. They just are decorations that are there for information purposes, because if they change what your program was doing, we'd have problems with things that are inconsistent. And you'd find that as you were gradually adding types to your program, you might start very dynamic and decide to structure it better over time when you knew what was going on. But subtle changes might occur and your program might behave differently. That's one of several reasons why a real cornerstone of this language design philosophy is that the types do not change the program behavior at all.
Interesting.
So, an example, you can't do type-based overloading, right? You can't declare methods with two different methods with the same name and a different type signature, because we're not going to choose which one to call based on the type signature. There may not be a type signature. So it does have, you know, all kinds of effects on how you do things, and that may take people getting used to. They may ask, like, couldn't you use the type for this particular thing? And sure, it seems harmless locally, but you have to think about the systemic effect.
Okay.
And it also means we can evolve the language, because the execution of the language isn't dependent on the type, so we can refine the type system independently of anything else without hurting anything, without breaking anything. So that's a big, you know, distinguishing feature of our approach.
Okay, now let's go way up at like 30,000 feet, and I guess, you know, the question I want to ask is, you know, what problems does Dart solve? So when you looked at, okay, we need to create a new language to solve this subset of problems, and this isn't a question about this versus that. It's really, what's your vision?
We want it to make it easier for people to write web applications.
Okay.
Typical web application today, you're writing in several languages. There's a server side that's often written in different languages, and we're not the first to come up with this idea that you should have a way to write in one language. I mean, you know, you at Microsoft might have actually have a thought in this direction in the past too. But in practice, people are still doing it because they find that it's not that easy, and there's an impedance mismatch, and ultimately, we would like a language where, you can write on the same code on the server and on the client, and they can talk to each other naturally. That's one thing. But the 30,000-foot picture is just make it easier to write really cool web apps. Okay. Because today, a really, really nice web app that's competitive with a native app is really hard. I mean, people do it once in a while, but it's extraordinary. You have to be really good, and you have to jump through hoops. And you have to worry about, you know, which servers am I talking to, because the browser has a one origin policy, and you bounce messages through your server to get information from the other one, and you twist yourself in knots, right? And this isn't just about language, it's about what library support and what, you know, what the distribution model. We're doing an actor-based concurrency model, which will let you sort of send messages, so a natural thing would be to have your client be one actor. We call them isolates. One isolate's on the client, isolates are on the server, they send messages to each other, things like that. So altogether, make it really easy to write web apps that are as good as native apps. That's the goal now.
Interesting.
You know, give us some time. It won't happen overnight. But
so when you say as good as native apps, I mean, in some sense...
Better,
huh?
Maybe potentially better, right? But it shouldn't be hard. Writing good apps is always hard. It shouldn't be harder to write them for the web than it is... Or, you know, on a normal platform.
Well, what about the notion of, you know, the web is this sort of matrix, this distributed mesh, or mess, if you will, depending upon how you look at it, to use some Giladisms. Talk to me a little bit about that, though. I mean, it's a complicated problem when you have all of these distributed sources. Mm-hmm. You have physics problems like latency, which is not going to be solved with software. You have a lot of problems to face.
Right. So this is where the actor model seems relevant, right? This is the people who invented the actor model, like Carl Hewitt, 1972, right? People were almost using abacuses back then, right? It's just astounding the vision that some of these researchers had. But the basic idea is that it models concurrent computation or distributed computation as individual units that have their own memory that can't touch each other's internals at all. They have to send messages, and these messages get queued up, and you cannot assume, you know, guaranteed delivery or guaranteed ordering or things like that. Maybe higher layers try to assume that. But yes, you do have to cope with distribution, and people are doing it on the web today, but they you're trying to get rid of the arbitrary complexity, the extra layers of impedance mismatches between languages and tools and clunky APIs and stuff, and give people a uniform, nice abstraction. It doesn't hide the distribution, but it gives people a nice way to talk about that. And you can wrap heterogeneous systems behind this abstraction, right? So your server might not actually be in Dart, but can you get an API that makes it look like Dart? Like there's something that's accepting messages as if it were a Dart isolate, and it's really a wrapper around something that talks to something else. So you have a more uniform way of, and this sort of goes back to Alan Kay's vision of the internet as well. Again, you know, amazing stuff, you know, when in the beginning, in the 70s, when they started Smalltalk and all these ideas and invented the Ethernet and GUIs and all the stuff that was invented at Xerox PARC. This notion that computation would be that way was part of that. And we're kind of, it's taking a generation to get there, but I think that helps address that as well.
Excellent. Now you mentioned, you know, I'm going to assume that not everybody in the audience will understand what an actor is.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Can you talk a little bit just briefly to catch everybody up on
this? Thanks for bringing me down to earth, Charles.
Of course.
So we call them isolates. The basic idea is you have something that has its own memory, its own heap, its own stack, and its own thread of control. Each actor is strictly sequential. There's no locking. The concurrency only happens among the actors. The code you write in an actor is strictly sequential. Because there's no locking, because there's no shared memory. It's a shared nothing approach. If you want to talk to something else, you send it a message. And you think about, the post office or something, right? Someone's remote. You can't actually get at them directly. So you send this message in an envelope, and it may take time to get there, and you're not quite sure when it'll get there and in what order. Maybe something else will get there. And sometimes you give people a bit more guarantees on these things in the software fabric. But that means that you can organize your program without worrying about the race conditions in that same way. There are many variations of actor paradigms, but if you can arrange things so that things are non-blocking, so you technically cannot deadlock. So concurrency is never easy, but this seems to make it a lot easier or less hard. And it's starting to get popular. I mean, we certainly didn't invent this idea. Carl Hewitt did, and Gulaga, and so forth. But it's also gotten a lot of traction through Erlang and through Akka. And Scala has actually started with its own actor framework internally. And now I think they're doing a lot of work with Akka and things like that. So this idea is, its time has finally come.
Sure.
And Node.js to some extent is a fairly, I don't mean this to be too pejorative, but low level mechanism, because on top of this basic framework, this basic plumbing, there are any number of variations of how you actually write your software, what the protocols are. So Erlang does it one way. There are other approaches. Await and async in C# 4.0 is not quite the same, but it's related. You can imagine doing things that way. You guys had your reasons for doing that, which largely had to do with compatibility with your existing way of doing things. You know, there's somewhat less of a pressure to do it exactly that way in a new system, but it's actually something we're looking at. Then there's a thing called promise pipelining, which is my favorite, which is kind of a cool way of doing things. So there's different high-level things you can build on top of that basic plumbing. We haven't. This isolate stuff is the youngest part of Dart, which is a very young system. I mean, it's not a product or anything. It's a technology preview, though we expect it to turn it into a product. But the point is, it's all very new, and we just don't have the answers necessarily yet. But we have to come up with them in a hurry, so we will have answers, right or wrong, pretty soon.
Now, one of the other things, of course, that you do in Dart is you compile to JavaScript.
Yes.
So that you have this notion of you know, compatibility with the web or whatever the reasons are you're doing that. When you're designing a higher level, in this case, it's not really like a coffee script, but when you're designing with compiling the JavaScript in mind up front, how does that impact your design decisions of the language itself?
It's a constraint, and it's a pretty tough constraint, because JavaScript wasn't designed as a compilation target, right? It's being used that way because if you want to run your stuff in the web browser, if you want to run an application in the web browser, you basically either write JavaScript directly or compile to JavaScript. Or I suppose you can use Flash or whatever, but if you want it to run everywhere, you have to do that. And that makes, you know, you can it's a Turing complete language, of course you can do whatever you want, but if you want it to be reasonably efficient, you find that to be quite constraining. So there's some features we'd like to have that we haven't put in. There's some features we have and it's a real struggle, and we yet may find we have to change them or something because we're still working on it, but we've gotten pretty decent results so far. And we hope to be able to compile essentially with no significant loss of efficiency. But give you examples of things that are difficult. So there's a feature, well, I don't know if I should get so technical. There's a thing called non-local return.
Okay.
That's how return statements work in Smalltalk and in Scala, though in Scala perhaps they work both ways. Scala is a fairly feature-rich language. It's really nice for doing your own control constructs, because it basically means that when you return from a closure, you actually return from the surrounding method. And so you can write like a method that takes a closure that'll be like an if method. It could take two closures for the then and else paths. And you send it literal lambdas, delegates, closures, whatever you want to call them. And when you decide you have to break out of this code and get rid of it, you write a return, and it's really going to pop out of the whole thing, right? It also means that you can wrap any piece of code in a closure and it continues to behave the same way. Has some nice properties. When you describe it to people, they get a little surprised, but when they use it, they don't even notice. And we'd like to have done that, but to implement that, since JavaScript doesn't do it that way, you sort of have to throw exceptions and catch them, and it gets fairly expensive. And we don't want to lose efficiency. That's one particular feature that I'm very sad that we lost because of that constraint. There's challenges around the numbers. JavaScript has only doubles, basically. It was one number type, which is IEEE dumb. And so we want to provide people with real integers. We are providing them integers, but that's hard.
I bet.
And so it's a challenge. Definitely a challenge. And I've done work on, we should probably mention NewSpeak.
Yes, of course.
I did work on the NewSpeak to JavaScript compiler.
Interesting.
And we found it really painful to get efficiency is, because with NewSpeak our goals were where we could afford to be more purist, and we were not going to compromise the existing NewSpeak semantics one bit. But that did mean that at least the initial implementation was not very efficient, shall we say.
Sure.
And maybe that can be engineered around, but it took more resources than we had for NewSpeak. So I'm painfully aware of how hard that is. Fortunately, I don't have to do that anymore. There's people who are much better at that at Google who will do that for us, and
sure,
hopefully we'll get to decent performance on JavaScript.
So now, speaking of NewSpeak, what's new?
So NewSpeak is alive and well. It's not, it's not one of those massive, taking over the world things. But it is, it's still being used at Cadence. They're actually building product on top of it. They're now a small team again, starting up that there are people who are paid full time to keep it alive and well.
Good.
We had a release in August. We've had a real bleeding edge release just now in October, and probably the next release will be better for people because the releases have sort of moved design and features and things we wanted to have there more than perhaps robustness, shall we say. But that now that there's actually people, I myself have much less time for it than I used to, sadly, because Dart is sort of my full-time job.
Sure.
But there are people who are who are paid to keep the engineering. So you shouldn't expect necessarily a lot of new features there in the short term. Newspeak isn't the kind of language that needs new features. It's more the very general purpose abstractions that can adapt to most anything in the Lisp Smalltalk tradition. But we've gotten a lot of stuff that we said we'd do, we actually have done. So the whole IDE is now written in Newspeak. Wow. There's a core library in Newspeak. The JavaScript effort, which isn't public, was essentially bootstrappable, so it was a complete little Newspeak platform that would go to the browser.
Wow.
I'm hoping to get that out. We did that at SAP. We're trying to open source that. These processes take time. I'm hoping that they'll do the right thing and we'll get that out.
Okay.
But generally, we are much closer to a completely bootstrappable system now. There's various things in there. The pattern matching experiment is in there, various other, the new mirror system completely cleaned up, really nice.
Mirror in terms of reflection.
Reflection, right, which again is an idea that, is getting more and more widespread. So V8 actually uses mirrors for JavaScript, for example. And Dart, of course, will use mirrors. another one of those ideas that we worked on from before my time. Dave Unger started this himself, and we had it in StrongTalk, and it's found its ways into the Java debugging interface in various ways. But it's more and more getting out there into the world.
So if you look at JavaScript for example, because you mentioned V8, the VM for JavaScript and Chrome. What are the scenarios where reflection is a required ingredient in dynamic code in JavaScript?
Well, okay, so there's a difference between required. There are a lot of scenarios where it's used where it isn't required, I want to say first. Because, the point about mirrors is that they help stratify things. So there's a layer of reflection that's easily separable from your base language. One of the characteristics of a lot of these scripting languages is that they don't have that stratification. And they kind of induce the programmer to use these dynamic things even when they're not particularly needed. And one of their effects is that they're used a lot to configure the program when it's starting up, which doesn't have to be that way if things are done differently. In particular, that's often an efficiency penalty. Example in Dart, we'll probably encourage people to use it a lot less.
Okay.
Because if you know that the program isn't changing under your feet, you can optimize more, minify, as they say, for JavaScript, get rid of code that isn't going to get used and things like that.
Okay.
It's very hard to do that if reflection is going on and you don't know what code might suddenly get used. But there are scenarios where it's really necessary. You need to create code on the fly in response to something. You need to evolve your application and modify it for some reason and update it in some way. And there's all kinds of neat tricks you can play with things like no such method, where you trap situations where a method wasn't defined and then actually respond to it intelligently. If you want to set up a forwarder, something that delegates to something else. I hate to use the word delegation here because it has different meanings, but you have an API and it's emulating it. It's a proxy or something like that. Well, it's very hard to go off and fill up all the API that it supports.
Yep.
Right? On the other hand, if you say, everything that you call, every method that comes to me, I'm just going to trap it, even though I don't support it, so I get a no such, rather than a no such method error, the no such method trap sort of catches it, and I have a no such method that is designed to handle that trap, and it decides, okay, now I'll forward it to this target that I have that may change dynamically or things like that. Tricks like that, people do a lot. Development environments, of course, benefit enormously from this ability to modify, right? There's a style of development where you literally write your program by debugging it. So you can start if the language is dynamic enough, you start from writing your test case. You call it, and there's no code there, and it screams, this class isn't there. Okay, I haven't stopped. I'm in the process. So, okay, let me define the class. So now I call the constructor. Oh, the constructor isn't there. I'll fill it up. I see what's coming in. I actually see the actual real data that I'm getting, and I can. It's less abstract. It's more concrete for the programmer. There are people who love to actually sort of fill in their application that way and keep going. I mean, that's the very extreme edge of it. So there are a lot of cool things you can do.
Cool. Now, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced when coming into the dark world?
I've only been there 3 months, and it wasn't that much of a shock because I know a lot of the people involved. I've worked with them before. In some sense, there was the constraints of, this has to be for the mainstream syntactically and so forth. It has to compile to JavaScript. It has to be done really fast, where the pace is pretty intense. And sometimes, my intent would have been to do something more like the original StrongTalk system, which did more type checking. I was sort of surprised the first time I saw how the guys had interpreted this idea. But it grows on you. It works really well, and people we've had who've done internal development, we have some apps and stuff, we're very, very happy with it. So I don't think it's been a very traumatic experience at all.
Interesting. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, great, Gilad. It's always great to talk to you.
Great being here. So thanks for having me.
Of course. And what do you think of Splash?
Splash is always fun. I've been going to Splash for more years than I dare admit. And it's a good, Portland is a great location for it. And there's been some wonderful talks. Dave Unger's talk on is really a forward-looking stuff about new models of concurrency and different ways of thinking about the world. There were some great talks about Dart too. Somebody gave one yesterday morning.
I think his name is Gilad.
It could be, yeah, great talk. I really liked it.
I like the title, A Shot in the Dart.
Yeah, we have a lot of that, the Dart theme.
Excellent. Well, hey.
Very good.
Take care.
Thank you.